Hello, this is Carrie Weber, Associate Editor for America. This week, we're speaking with Father Greg Boyle, a Jesuit priest and founder of Homeboy Industries, which celebrates its 25th anniversary this year. Father Greg is also the author of Tattoos on the Heart, The Power of Boundless Compassion, which made the New York Times bestseller list. Homeboy Industries serves high-risk, formerly gang-involved men and women with free programs like tattoo removal, legal services, and mental health services. It also operates 7 social enterprises that serve as job training sites, including Homeboy Bakery, Homegirl Cafe, and Homeboy Silkscreen and Embroidery. We spoke with Father Greg at the Los Angeles Religious Education Congress after he offered to talk about his work to a large crowd, moving many to tears. Father Greg Boyle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you.
Now, this year marks the 25th anniversary of Homeboy Industries, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
And what do you think has been the biggest challenge to you over the years? Is there something that sticks out?
Well, you know, over 25 years, we've had lots of challenges. The first one, I think, was the wholesale demonizing of this population. So that was something we had to deal with in the early first 10 years. And that was the predominant kind of attitude towards gang members. So, you know, the first 10 years were marked by death threats, hate mail, and bomb threats. You know, that's sort of how Homeboy Industries was received. Not so much anymore now. And then it was always a challenge to try to locate employers who are willing to be kind of felony friendly,
right?
You know, to hire people with felonies. Right. And now the challenge, of course, is to try to meet payroll and keep your doors open. I hate that part, but that's always the case.
What do you think people objected to? I mean, the aim is to help rehabilitate people, to help rebuild people's lives. What is there to object to?
Well, you know, if you think that gang members are not part of the us, that they're them, then it's a short hop to, you know, demonize somebody who's trying to help them. So it's kind of the Middle Eastern dictum, you know, the friend of our enemy is our enemy. So that was so pervasive, especially from law enforcement. Law enforcement had so kind of categorized these folks as the bad guy.
Right.
So it was easy for us to be painted with the same brush as somehow co-signing on bad behavior, as if, you know, we were just trying to help folks and try to address the undergirding despair that kind of led to this symptom of violence. But I think that's changed in the city of L.A. You know, you can be heartened by the fact that change does come incrementally, slowly, but it comes. So it really has in L.A. because Homeboy Industries now is sort of hoisted on the shoulders of the people in L.A. And that would have been inconceivable 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
And those are sort of organizational challenges. What are some challenges that you have felt personally throughout this?
Well, you know, it's always, I think in the early days I wanted to save people and that it was almost enough for me to want it more than the kid wanted it. And no amount of me wanting that homie to have a life was the same as that homie wanting to have one. So you had, it's sort of like recovery in addiction. You know how parents will look at their kid, and any parent with a kid who's addicted would sign up for a drug rehab for themselves if they felt, you know, that would help their kid. But, you know, you can't. Ours is a God who waits, and who are we not to? So you have to wait for folks to kind of be ready. Coupled with the fact that relapse happens, you know,
right.
So homies at our program, 2 steps forward, 5 steps backwards, they always kind of often enough regress back into this place.
And how would you define your relationship with the men and women with whom you work? I'm sure people like to try to assign a label to what you do, and I wonder if you sort of try to, you know, defy labels or if you have a very specific vision of what you think working with them means.
Well, I don't try to be any label. You know, but folks will transfer and slap a label on you, you know. So I think the homies would say, you know, father and who knows what, friend. So there's not much I can do about how people see me. But the main thing is community trumps gang. So Homeboy Industries is a community, you know, of healing, and it's therapeutic, and it helps homies reimagine and re-identify who they are in the world. You know, if previously they thought courage was packing a gun, now they're able to say, oh, okay, I see that that has nothing to do with courage. Right. So real life community will always shine a light on your empty, hollow gang past. Right. And that's, in fact, what happens there. And then homies gain a certain kind of resilience, and then they can re-identify who they are in the world. And at that point, they're able to leave homeboy. And the world will throw at them what it will, but they won't be toppled by it this time.
It would seem that a lot of people would be seeking that sort of community, that family, that hope within the gang communities, and don't necessarily find it there, or find it there, but with sort of these side effects of violence.
Yeah, it's homies will speak that way. They'll self-present that way. They'll say, oh, when I was a kid, that's what I wanted. I wanted wine, women, and song, you know, join a gang and see the world. But they can only say that because they're unable to say, you know, my mom used to put cigarettes out on me and hold my head in the toilet and flush till I nearly drowned. That's why that kid joined the gang. He wasn't trying to belong. He wasn't seeking something. He was fleeing something. And so the outsider view has always driven the insight of how we see this. People look at it and try to be rational. Oh, I see. Yeah, they just want to belong. Oh, that's why a kid joins a gang. But it's really about a lethal absence of hope. You know, it's about kids being unable to imagine a future. And kids join gangs because they've encountered their life as a misery, and misery loves company. But we're always, because we want to make things rational, we want to think, we kind of want to put that overlay on this, and it's kind of operates at some level that's sub-rational.
How are you yourself healed by working in this ministry?
Well, I think it's only about me being healed. You know, I mean, I think in the end, as I was saying today in the talk, you know, I think it's that's the intentionality of what we do is really about not trying to change folks or save people, but to sort of savor them, you know, and cherish them and delight in them. It's a little like a mother who works in my office was talking. I asked about her daughter who's in college, sophomore in college, and she sent me an email and told me about how she's doing. And her last line was, "She is my teacher." Well, I think any parent can connect to that. You know, if you're a good parent, your kid is your teacher. You're probably a questionable parent if you are the teacher. If you're kind of, well, I've taught this kid everything I know. I go, yeah, you know, that's funny. That's not how it works. That it really is your kid is going to know that she is valuable if that kid has a parent who values her. And the same is true for gang members. And that's like a drop of water on a dry old sponge. It just comes alive, you know.
Now, you also spoke today about what you called encounters that sort of take you to that place. When you encounter somebody who is very frustrating or makes you somewhat very angry, actually, and that you go to this very angry place and it's hard to get away from there. What is something that takes you to this place? And what do you think that others can do to remove themselves from that place?
Well, I guess I was sort of talking about that. And it's also, you know, just one of the things that homies have taught me over the years. You have to do the work on yourself. Otherwise, you're not freed and you're endlessly brought to that place. And that's kind of not what you hope will happen. You hope somehow we'll be able to be free enough to have a light grasp enough to not have this have such an impact on us. The homies always have taught me how to do that. And I wouldn't say that I'm always good at it, but it's, in fact, I'm probably not. But I know that it's a measure of your, you know, working on yourself constantly to be able to not allow that to happen.
You offer a lot of services through your industries and a lot of job opportunities. Which aspect of homeboy industries do you think has most surprised you over the years in a way, in the way that people have reacted to it as being meaningful or useful?
I think people are surprised sometimes about tattoo removal. They, you know, what difference does it make? One side would say, what difference does it make? Others would just be surprised that that has such an impact. And again, there is no service that we provide that we wasn't born from listening to this population, where they say, you know, this is what I want, this is what I need. So, you know, humility listens to people and says, how can we help you? Hubris says, here's how you fix yourself. And so tattoo removal has been one of those things where, you know, I've been able to listen to people, and homies have said that it's an obstacle to their future. And even quite beyond job, accessibility, it's also about, yeah, I don't want my kid to see this. So it's an important psychological thing. Plus, you send a message to friend and foe alike, I don't want anything to do with this anymore. So it's kind of important.
What moment in the past 25 years has been the most humbling to you?
Oh, I think it's always humbling to just kind of watch folks become the truth of who they are, where they recognize that they're exactly what God had in mind when God made them. And so, and I don't feel like I can do that for somebody. I think all you can do is really hold the mirror up and have somebody recognize themselves. And that's a humbling experience for sure.
What is the most moving or surprising moment for you over the past 25 years?
Oh God, there's so many moving moments. It all is. I've buried 185 young people who've been killed because of gang violence, and kids I loved who were killed by kids I love. And so that's always kind of a gut-wrenching thing. If the ministry was only that, then I suppose nobody could do it. But it's mainly delighting, and it's mainly life soaring and wonderful. So I wouldn't trade my life for anybody's.
What is the biggest assumption people make about the work that you do?
I don't think people make assumptions about the work that we do so much as they kind of jump to conclusions about who these folks are. And so I think they feel like, as Sister Helen Prejean says, everybody's a whole lot more than the worst thing they ever did. Well, society will kind of make this assumption about people that that's who you are. And that's a dangerous and terrible and untruthful accusation, because demonizing isn't just morally bankrupt, it's untruthful. In fact, nobody knows a demon. And we belong to each other and we're all members of the same human race. And the more that we can get to that point, the better.
How has Homeboy Industries met your vision or surpassed your vision of what you thought it would be 25 years ago?
Well, I never had a vision of what Homeboy Industries would be, so thank goodness. I never had a business plan. I never had any kind of sense. It evolved. So people will go to our headquarters today, 25 years into this endeavor. Wow, how did you even think of this? Well, the truth is I didn't. None of us did. You back your way into stuff. And it evolves, and you add, and you subtract. And people will suggest a thing, and the homies will kind of say, well, what if we had this? And next thing you do. So we're in our currently we're in our fourth location, so it's huge. And we serve, 15,000 people a year who walk through our doors. And we're the largest gang intervention rehab and reentry program in the country. And nobody would, in their right mind, would have ever set out to be such a thing, Be nice if we were still sort of a storefront, but it's too late. Now we're big. Yeah.
What are the special challenges that come with the larger size?
Well, it's a $14 million annual operation, and so our businesses bring in about $5 million. So I have to beg and raise $10 million a year, which is a daunting prospect. And yet we save $50 million a year for L.A. County and the same amount for the state of California. According to research from UCLA, they maintain that were we not to exist, then they'd have to expend that kind of money, the state and the county, to incarcerate these folks. But we engage so many folks, gang members from L.A. County, and that has a singular impact on public safety in the county, and that costs a lot of money. So it's hard to convince the powers that be that, if they sent some of the savings from that to us, it would be significant.
And is this something you see yourself in for the long haul, or do you feel like maybe one day you want to break off and start another small thing that could build up somewhere else? Or
no, I figure, I don't really see myself being around for the long haul, frankly. And I mean, in life, I guess, I don't know. But I don't see myself doing anything else. I kind of what I'm doing. Gives me life. That's where you should be, wherever you're given life. The minute it stops doing that, I suppose you move on. But as it is, I don't really run the thing anymore. I have people who do it. So it's a different role for me, really.
And you find life in this new role?
Yeah, you know, I give a lot of talks, and but I'm kind of in and out of the place. But, you know, if you're not there, I used to micromanage the place 100 years ago, you know. And now, you know, my staff, they use muscles that they don't use if I'm there. So it's nice to have them take total ownership. And you know, half of the people who I'm talking about are gang members who have moved up in the organization and now run things. So it's great to see that it's become theirs, you know. I have my role, and I, you know, show up.
In your talk today, there were a number of really humorous stories of your encounters with the people that you work with and the people that you visit and the people that you give talks to. What is one of the funniest or most joyous moments of your last 25 years in this?
Oh, God, I have too many. And I find if you don't pepper your talk with enough things that people will nod off. So if you can keep it funny enough, if it's all content, they'll go nuts. Oh, I don't know. One of my favorite ones was I was on a radio call-in show in Spanish early morning during the early morning drive. Two guys were interviewing me in Spanish, and it was call-in, so people would call in, and in Spanish, you know, they'd say, this is a Maria from Compton, and she'd go on about her son, who was a gang member. So I tried to give advice in Spanish. So this went on for 2 hours. Finally, it was towards the end. It was like 9:05, and we were about to finish. I thought, oh, thank God, I'm trying to do my Spanish as best I can. And then we said, tenemos una llamada de Filiberto. We have a call from Filiberto, from Downey. And I go, oh, that's funny. I have a guy who works for me named Filiberto. He's from Downey. And all of a sudden on the loudspeaker you hear, hey, gee, this is Philly. Yeah, I'm not feeling so good. So I'm just calling to tell you I won't be coming into work. So Philly used a radio call-in show to call in sick to work. And I was just completely flabbergasted. I went, okay, Phil, sorry, I hope you feel better. And I remember walking to the car, and you know how you play stuff in your head. I replayed it, and I just died laughing. And I remember just thinking, I would not trade my life for anybody's. It was just so hilarious. But he thought nothing of it to call in and say, and it was a huge radio, Spanish, very popular radio college show, to just say, I won't be coming in.
Oh, you know, that's
thanks
great.
For calling.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, years down the road, what do you hope people think of when they think of Homeboy Industries?
Well, you know, Homeboy Industries is a program that helps people, but it's also a symbol. It announces a message. You know, what if we were to invest in people rather than continually trying to incarcerate our way out of this problem? So 40 programs in the country have been spawned, born from Homeboy. We've gone out there, they come out to here. And this year, in our 25th year, we're going to convene everybody, the 40 programs across the country, and we call it the Homeboy Network. So rather than franchise Homeboy across the country, we rather have people design their own from below, so it would have greater ownership by the local community. But we'll help give technical assistance, if you will. So that's been a very heartening thing. I don't really care about legacies, you know, but in the end, you know, you get to a point where you say, well, do you just keep growing and having Homeboys Industries all over the country? And we kind of made a decision about 7 years ago that we wouldn't do that, that we would instead encourage this kind of new thing. You know, here's a model, and to the extent that it makes sense in your community, then we'll help you start something up. So that's kind of what we've done, and so that feels organic to me and the way it should be, rather than becoming the McDonald's of gang intervention. Over 5 billion gang members served. So we don't want to do that.
Right. Keeping it local. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your time and for your great work and for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. Privileged to be with you.